Blog Talk Radio.
Air breathe, air blow, make this wheel of magic go, work this wish for which we pray, eo dio ha hey ye. Water bubble, water boil, make this wheel of magic toil, work this wish for which we pray, eo dio ha hey ye.
Eo dio ha hey ye. Eo dio ha hey ye. Eo dio ha hey ye. Eo dio ha hey ye.
Earth without, earth within, make this wheel of magic spin, work this wish for which we pray, eo dio ha hey ye.
Eo dio ha hey ye. Eo dio ha hey ye. Eo dio ha hey ye. Eo dio ha hey ye.
Fire blaze, fire burn, make this wheel of magic turn, work this wish for which we pray, eo dio ha hey ye.
Eo dio ha hey ye. Eo dio ha hey ye. Eo dio ha hey ye.
How are you, everybody? It's Brian here, and we've got Joy in studio with us. Welcome
hey,
to
everyone.
The premiere of Magical Musings.
Yeah, we're going to, this is going to be the first episode that we're doing of Magical Musings. We've got actually one from Magical Mondays, which is what we were trying to start before. It was an abortive attempt. We didn't have everything together. We didn't have a website. We didn't have stuff going. So we're trying to get all that together now. And I think we've got it, you know, we took the summer off. I think we've got everything together. Tonight's show, we're going to talk to you guys a little bit about, first off, Magical Musings, the website and the show, and what we're going to do. And then we're going to, Brian and I are going to talk about Druidism, and Druidry in general. We're not going to get into any of the dogma, the different groups, because honestly, there's too many groups out there for us to get specific like that. But we can talk about the typical type of groupings. And then we're going to, you know, promote the next show, and I'm going to beg for money and, you know, things like that, like you hear on podcast. So, you know, we're on for the next 2 hours, so hope y'all can join us.
And actually, in the second part of the show, if you guys feel like you want to call in and offer a comment or something, you can reach us at 646-564-9666. I think that's based in New York City, actually.
That is probably not going to be a permanent call-in number, though. So if you're hearing a recording of this, you're not going to be able to get a hold of us. Don't hang on to that, because what I'm trying to do, I'm the webmistress for Magical Musings. Brian is doing the promotion, the ad selling, and most of the other things like that. But we're also, you know, coming up with the shows and everything. So what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to direct those of you that are live to go to the magicalmusings.net website, and I'm going to talk to you about the website for just a little bit. Right now it's still kind of simple. It's, you know, based on a WordPress blog, like you can probably tell. On the left-hand side, there's the columns where you have the podcasts. And that's where all the old episodes of the various podcasts that we're going to have are going to be archived permanently, so that you can go back and you can find them at any time. There's a link to Tarot Talk. All 16 episodes from that are archived on the website already, so that you can play them at any time. You can go back to them. You can download them. There's information on what we discussed that night on the page for it. There's a direct link so that you can play it straight from our website. It's no problem. Feel free to do that. Feel free to download them and archive them, because this is actually the continuation of the Tarot Talk. Okay, Tarot Talk was, I guess, an experiment that Brian and I were doing. Brian tried to have Woodwoes Radio for a long time and was working really hard at doing it, and it got really scattered, unfortunately. And he asked for somebody to come on and do a series on tarot cards, which is what I did. And we kind of narrowed the focus back down into the 201, 301, 401 information for paganism instead of trying to get really pan-galactic gargle blaster, sometimes happens. We just wanted to get something very specific that isn't out there anywhere. And I'm hoping that this is what we're going to be doing. As you can also see on the left-hand side, we've got a link to the forums. We are going to have live forums that are up there. Feel free to drop in at any point in time, make a user ID, comment on the shows, start threads on whatever you want to talk about, suggestions, ideas for other shows, things like that. Okay. Let's see. If we go on down, there's sections for the various articles. And, of course, in the middle, we've got, you know, the podcast blog, which is where we'll give you ideas or thoughts, what's happening, various articles that just, you know, come to us, and we'll, you know, post something about it, and you can comment on those or whatever. If you look just under the big masthead where it says Magical Musings, there are three links that are horizontal. One says about this site, one says Forum Quest, and the other says Broadcast Calendar. About this site is actually, that's what it is. It's about this site. It's our little description of what's going on, but it's also how you can contact us. There's a contact form in there, and you can send us feedback, you can ask questions, or you can email us through that. The Forum Press page is just a page, it's a holder page for the actual forum, and that's where you would go to interact with other listeners, with us, and do whatever talking or, you know, comments or whatever that you need to. The Broadcast Calendar is what I want to bring your attention to right now. That is an updated calendar of the shows that we're going to do and when we're going to do them. Okay. If you click on that link right now and go there, you have a calendar. The day that it is highlighted in white. The blue links are the shows that we're going to be doing. The pink links are what holidays are coming up. Okay. So as you can see, on the 31st, we've got a show. We've also got it's Samhain that day. We have a show next week and the week after and on the 24th and so on, okay? If you click on these links, you're going to get a bit more of a description up top. It'll tell you exactly, you know, the notes that I put in there about it, what the show is about, and when we're going to be broadcasting it, okay? Not only the date, but also the time. Anytime that we do a show, for right now at least, it's going to be 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern time on Thursdays, every Thursday, 2 hours. So you get to listen to us chant every 2 hours, every week for 2 hours, and I hope you can put up with us. But that's it on the website. So, you know, if you've got any comments or thoughts about it, feel free to drop us a line, shoot us an email, post something in the forum. You know, we want your feedback. We want your thoughts so that we know how we're doing and what's going on, okay? So, all right. There's a whole bunch of people in the chat room on Blog Talk Radio, and that's great. So let's go ahead and start talking about the main show, not the ads for the site, but for Druidism. So that's, you know, what we're here tonight. And Brian and I decided to do this show tonight because both of us are Druids, different orders, but we both studied Druidism and Druidry. We're both initiated into our own traditions. I'm initiated into the Ordrakat Yusmith, which is a I don't even know how to say it, a hive off, if you will, of the Henge of Keltria. So it's Irish based. It's set up around Irish deities and so on. Brian?
I'm a member of OBAD, the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids, based out of the UK. I'm also a non-active kind of member of our Dreoctfane ADF since 2004. And each of those, I mean, they fall under two different categories, the two that we're going to be talking about tonight. BOD, like AODA, the Ancient Order of Druids in America, and a number of others that are along the same line, fall under the category of Druidry, as far as I'm concerned, and ADF and a bunch of other orders, Keltria, etc., fall under the other category, Druidism, we're going to be talking about tonight as well.
All right. So let's start tonight by clarifying a few things. The difference between Druidism and Druidry is very distinct, okay? And you need to keep these in mind when we're talking about this. Druidism is a type of Druidism, or is a type of what the Druids did back in the, from like the 800 BCE, before Common Era, to about, about 200-300 CE, current era. So it's a period of about 1,000 years in there, where the Celts were. Okay, let's go back and get even more basic and start on history. The history of Druidism, practice, comes from the Celtic peoples in Wales, in Ireland, in Scotland, although they are really the Picts, but England, and also the Gallic Celts in Spain and France, and not Germany so much. They were the Norse, and they were really kind of pricks towards the Celts, big enemies. But it's all pre-Roman times, okay? The Celtic people, from what we can tell, migrated out of the steppes of Russia like a lot of other people did, and sort of migrated east, west from there, and wound up settling down in a lot of places. You get a group that wound up in Greece. You got a group that wound up populating France, a group that wound up populating Spain, and that area. And they're the Gauls. And they're what the Italians found when they came in to conquer everything. And when you hear about Caesar's Gallic Wars, that's who he was fighting. Okay. Now the Romans did conquer the European continent. They started coming over into the British Isles and conquering the Celts there. But they didn't really get that deep. I mean, we've got Hadrian's Wall cutting England off from Scotland, and that's because the people that were on the other side of the Hadrian's Wall were just too savage, and they had to protect themselves from it. The Romans never got into Ireland. So we've got total subsummation of the culture in Europe. We've got a partial conquering of the Londinium and the British Celts. You've got a partial conquering of the Welsh Celts, and you've got an influence through trade and religion and learning that wound up in Ireland. Okay, so that's what we're talking about when we talk about there's four real main branches of modern Druidism and Druidry, okay? As Brian was saying, there's Druidism, who is trying to take what the Celts and the Druids of Roman times and bring it forward to now, as if the Roman invasions never happened, and trying to make sure that the modern world is folded into the worship as much as possible, so that it's a living, breathing religion that everybody can, that is a substitute really for, you know, Hinduism and Buddhism and Christianity and all those out there. Okay, Druidry, on the other hand, is trying to understand what the Celts, pre-Roman invasion did, how they worshipped, what they were, and trying to recreate that as much as possible before moving on. Okay? I think I've got my terms right. I mean, Brian's not jumping all over me, so I must have them. And that's pretty much... Go ahead.
No, go ahead. It's pretty much...
Well, no, that's pretty much the basic definition. You've got the groups that are trying to practice as if nothing happened, and then you've got the groups that are trying to recreate it from before. And so the Celtic Recon gets rolled into the Druid Re a lot. Druidism takes the path of the Druids, the gods of the Druids, the mindset of the Druids, the magic of the Druids, and go, okay, it started off in England, but we're actually in the United States. So let's transpose the land features and some of the mindset and some of the, I guess you could call it world feel, into the United States while keeping things like the triune thought and the virtues and how you worship the gods and things like that, okay? And that's where, you know, it really comes down to brass tacks. Personally,
well,
I think there's merit on both sides.
For sure. And I mean, it's really down to whether or not a particular person wants to practice something that... well, okay. I mean, the way I see it, the difference between Druidism and Druidry is that Druidism is, you can include Celtic Recon in that group. It's kind of an attempt to revitalize the original Iron Age, you know, Celtic paganism with relevance to the modern life that we have now. Whereas you've got Druidry that kind of, it has its root back in like the 17th, 13th centuries with like basically British Freemasons kind of thing. So there's a lot of influence of like the Rosicrucians and the Freemasons, and you know, it's a very occultic kind of mythical school, I guess.
Well, let's put it into a little context also. About the time that Druidism really started up as a modern movement, it was the late 1600s. There was a huge push for the not just the Age of Aquarius, but a rebellion against the church, really. Because up until that time, you had the Catholic Church, and then they split off into the Presbyterians and the Romitarians and the Armitarians and all the, you know, other little Christian groups. Well, you had Christianity and Judaism, and that was pretty much it. If you wanted to go really Eastern, you had Hindu, but that wasn't really big. But they started bringing it in. So into this mix, you get Levi, Elphas Levi, who was defrocked Catholic priest and thrown out of the church. Because he, you know, decided to question church beliefs. Then you've got Madame Blavatsky. You've got the Golden Dawn started up right around this time. You have the Emerald Tablet being found in Egypt. You've got a lot of people that are expressing interest in Egyptology and Eastern religions and faith paths and didn't know much about it. So you've got a lot of excitement for new and different. Into this comes John Tolland, who decided that he was going to make a fraternal order, and it was supposed to be a brotherhood. It was just like one of the fraternities, the Greek fraternities you find on a college campus now, and he decided to call it Druidism. And that's when you started the Ancient Druid Bond, I believe. I'd have to look that up.
I think he called it the Universal Bond.
The Universal Druid Bond, you're right.
Yeah, he used like the Irish Gaelic or something for that instead of calling it the Druid, or you know, Universal Bond or whatever it was.
Right. But what's important about this is that this is the first Druid order that is recognized as a Druid order to start out. And the Druid Bond, the ancient Druid Bond, has continued in one form or another since 1700. And in, you know, this life of disposable everything, you got to admit, 400 years of continuous through two world wars, all kinds of problems, and it's still around. That's impressive. I mean, even Wicca can only go back to the 1950s. They may have pulled... Oh, God, that was so loud in my ear. Yes, heresy. But that's what's verifiable. And we're talking about verifiable fact here. We're not talking about the ancient fantasy. We're talking about this is, you know, what we've actually found through research. There's a thing called research. Anyway, go ahead, Brian.
Obviously, you're talking crazy talk. Yeah, I mean, you've got Tolland, and you've got, like, a lot of people that through the course of that era were calling themselves Druid, who were typically Freemasons or Rosicrucians or what have you. And one of the sort of distinctive marks of Druidry is that it does include kind of the claim of heritage tracing back to Atlantis, to Egypt, and so on. But it comes at a time when people were really hooked on the idea that ancientness meant validity. And, you know, I mean, we've moved on from that perspective in the modern era. You know, you can make something up yesterday over pizza, and it can still be as valid and usable as anything, you know, 100, 200 years old. It's just that we no longer require that sort of ancientness to make it valid. And that's kind of a really big thing. There's people out there who, you know, in the pagan community, in a lot of spiritual traditions, really, who hold fast to the idea that ancient and valid are one and the same. There are people who, you know, decide that there are certain things that are valid because they're based on modern research. But when we're talking about what works in the process of spiritual development, we don't really need to worry about the ancientness or, you know, the heritage behind something. And I think there's a lot of neo-pagan druids who, you know, kind of turn their, you know, I guess hold crosses up kind of thing to the druidry because the idea that the influences of Freemasonry, ritual magic, and so on that are part of druidry are somehow invalid because they aren't the reconstruction of, you know, Iron Age beliefs.
Well, and, you know, you got to understand something also. The druids didn't really write anything down. I mean, there's scattered little bits of writings and bits and pieces, and the, you know, everybody says, oh, yeah, no, they didn't write anything down. Well, what about Agam? Agam was not a secret language of the druids. What Agam was a language of the educated. It was like being literate. And you translate Agam that you find these days, and you find out things like Gerald is a good comb maker. You know, it's not Secrets of the Universe, it's advertising. And, you know, so what we've got, you can't reconstruct something from the Iron Age when you have no information about it. And at best, what we have is scattered information from the druid's enemies. Now, when I say that, what I mean is not the Catalavones attacking the Iceni's, okay, because they were both druids. The druids were actually one class of people that could cross tribal lines. They were the peacemakers. They could go, the ambassadors, they could go from one tribe to another, even if they were deep in war, and not be killed and carry messages around and actually do peace settlements and things like that. But you know, the Catalavones didn't write anything down, and neither did the Iceni. What happened was that the Romans came running in, wiped out everybody there, and then, you know, observers at the time, like Pilney, would write down, oh, they have this wonderful festival. It happened somewhere around this time. They call it Beltania, and they drive oxen through the fires to cleanse them. And, you know, and then you go, okay, well, when was this? Well, we don't know. Why? Because he never wrote that down. It never occurred to him that there was a date for this. There's information, like there's one huge ritual that we have in very great detail called the Ritual of the Sixth Moon, okay, which is a huge celebration. The druids would go out into the forest at night on the sixth moon and cut mistletoe for various curative purposes, including cancer cures. And they would do this in a very big and ritualistic thing. Well, when was this? We have no clue. What does the sixth moon refer to? The sixth night after the full moon? The sixth full moon of the year? Well, where did you start the year? We don't know, because nobody wrote it down.
Well, and that's the big thing with the original Iron Age druids, is that we rely on a lot of commentary from those who conquered or traded with them to gain information about them. You know, and there's a lot of like pro-Roman records
propaganda.
That, you know, yeah, that's the word I was looking for, that talk about how, you know, the Druids were just oh so dreadfully evil, they performed human sacrifice and so on. And, you know,
which we'll address in a little while.
Well, exactly. You know, there's kind of a lot of trouble picking out the truth from the propaganda, because, you know, the Romans weren't very fond of the way things were being done by the Celts, because it was totally not Roman. And, you know, these people had, like, unkempt hair and big mustaches, and, you know, they were just terribly not Roman. And thus, therefore, you know, they were dreadfully unhuman kind of people.
Mm-hmm.
So
plus, the Gallic Wars was an unpopular war. So when Caesar's writing down, you know, how savage these people are, and sending it back, he's sending back propaganda to Rome to encourage them to send more money and more troops to, you know, conquer these people. It doesn't help him if he says, oh, well, I walked into this village, and this village was full of women and children. They all sat down, and they had dinner, and they were loving, and they were kind. You know, nobody'd send a troop for that. But if he sends back this long missive about, I walked in, and they had just slaughtered all the animals, and they had thrown them in the fire, and they were eating their bloody hunks of meat right out of the fire, and the children were running around and screaming, and the husbands were yelling at their wives and sharpening their swords. It makes them sound like barbarians. Yeah.
Well, and I mean, from the Roman perspective, everyone that wasn't, you know, influenced by Rome was a barbarian. So, I mean, even if you were a cultured civilization that was very advanced, if you weren't Roman, then God forbid, you know, you were obviously barbaric.
Yeah, look at how they treated the Huns for that crime.
This is true. This is very true.
So, yeah. We know some things, but most of what we have is written either by, you know, enemies or people that were observing it, or written centuries after the fact. There's several writings that we have that are supposedly druidic in Ireland. One of them's called the Red Book of War. Another one's called the Mabinogion from Wales. There's the calorative coulee. There's the Kukulain. The Colloquy of Two Sages. And all of these were written centuries after the fact by Christian monks who happened to be living in the culture of, of Ireland. They decided that they were going to take these stories that they were hearing from the populace and write them down. Well, you know, when you get to Cuchulainn called upon Nuada for strength to jump up and slay his enemies, the Christian monks are naturally going to, he called upon God to jump up and slay the enemies, and that slowly got translated as Christian God. So, you know, there's perspectives in there that are skewed as well, even though it's good information. A lot of druidry groups are trying to slowly pull out those little bits and pieces that were just assumed to have been in there and get back to what actually happened. For instance, the whole St. Patrick thing. Okay?
Exactly.
The big myth in druidry is that St. Patrick was a Christian saint, and he threw out all the serpents from Ireland. Okay? Well, as far as that goes, it's true. The interpretation, the modern sexy interpretation these days, is that the serpents refer to the druids. And through research, what they've come up with is they found that Patrick was actually a slave of one of the druids at one point in time, was rescued from a battlefield, was cared for. He converted to Christianity, went in back into Ireland, found what was going on, betrayed the druids by using all of his knowledge that he gained as a slave to one of the high druids. And the Christians were able to wipe out druidry as a group completely from Ireland. Okay, that's the sexy myth these days. What they're starting to discover more, we're not celebrating St. Patrick's Day because it's, you know, killing all the druids. And that's great, and that's fine. Don't celebrate it because it's a religious holiday of another religion. You know, if you want to use it to get drunk, use it to get drunk. But don't say that it's because something happened. Research, more modern research, has turned over information saying that, yes, while he was Irish himself, he wasn't a slave. He was a landowner who converted to Christianity, had been educated by the Druids. And more than that, there's other things. I haven't really studied the new theories yet. That's something that I keep putting off and meaning to do and not doing. But it's how the theories evolve again, okay? Take anything that you hear about the druids with a huge grain of salt, maybe a whole salt flat, like out in Utah.
It's true. I mean, there's a lot of information that, you know, we're putting together even in modern research that is based on, you know, filtering out some of the, you know, influences of Christianity, of, you know, the opponents to Celtic culture, etc.
And then you also have to understand that you got to get rid of the influence of the radical fundamenta pagans from the 70s and 80s.
Of course. Naturally.
You know,
I mean,
yeah, they got all those myths and they went, oh, he drove out the serpents, so he must have driven out the druids. Bad man. When there's tons of evidence saying that the druids were dying out as a group anyway, mainly because they weren't passing on their knowledge in an efficient manner. I mean, they were trying to cling to the old ways. They weren't changing with the times. The times had moved on. The populace was not literate. So having somebody sacrifice 20 years of their life to, you know, just get to the beginning steps of this faith path that's a little extreme, especially when you're talking about people that are an agrarian society in the Bronze Age or the beginnings of the Iron Age. You know, when you've got all these other things that are happening that are taking up massive chunks of your life, you're dealing with people who are trying to cope with that, and to ask them to give up a child so that they can go into the educational system of the Druids, while laudable, when it's going to take up their entire lifetime and you're not going to get anything back from it, and you've got a field to work and you've only got four children and you and your wife are getting older, that's probably not going to happen, you know. Which brings us as a... Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No.
I was just going to say that is kind of one of the things we were going to talk about anyway, was the very idea of the length of the training program that bards were said to go through, you know, something along the line of 19 years or what have you. But in an agrarian culture, I mean... You know, most of the people wouldn't literate. They wouldn't have a lot of basic education. So, you know, enter the bardic training programs and you've got people learning languages and history and, you know, all these other things that are, you know, that in the modern world we granted it, you know, through our elementary and, you know, high school, you know, educations.
Yeah. And that's something that, yeah, we were going to talk about. And the canard is that druids trained for 20 years to be druids. Well, that's true as far as that goes. But like Brian said, these days, the reason that we're not still training for 20 years to, you know, become a druid, because I know of nobody that goes through 20 years of training before they can be an initiated druid. And the reason for that is that a lot of the training that they were going through, we get in our elementary schools, in our secondary schools. You know, they were learning geography. They were learning astronomy. Not astrology, astronomy. They were learning navigation and mathematics and, you know, writing and their language and everything like that. And that's, you know, we've got an entire civilization built around that already, you know. So you got the first 12 years of your life, or 12 years of your life that is spent, you know, finding all of that and getting all of that in the first place. So you knock those out and you're down to what, 7 years? Well, if you go to college, you learn advanced stuff, music theory, how to play instruments, maybe poetry, philosophy, things like that. There's another 5 years. So now you're down to just 3 years of training in the religion. And that's what the Druid orders, modern Druid orders these days, are doing. They're just training the religion, not all the secondary school stuff that you should already have.
Well, yeah. And I think part of the reason that the training period is so short nowadays is that you get a lot of groups that release to the year and a day per degree kind of thing that was made popular through Wicca. I think, though, that part of that, depending on which particular order you grow, you know, you go through when you're taking your training, there's usually an oversight as far as compared religions and that sort of thing that I think really benefits anyone who's taking a training program to become any kind of pagan. And I know that's what my youth was spent doing, was, you know, exploring different mythology and religion and that sort of thing. So I think that's
just reading the mythology could take years. I mean, I don't know about you, but I fell in love with Edith Hamilton while I was in high school and devoured her book, and then went on to Bullfinches, and then went on to the Bhagavad Gita, and then found a lot of the Norse mythic cycles and started reading about those just to understand the different gods. And that's, you know, not even touching the religions that have those gods as characters or people in them. You know, so
yeah,
dealing with a whole lot of information.
Well, and I think that developing a proper understanding of any religion or spiritual path or any cult really has a lot to do with studying mythology and their kind of cosmology as well. I mm-hmm. think understanding mythology tells you how they saw the world. And that's kind of something, again, we tend to take for granted nowadays, because modern culture has said that there is a particular way to look at the world that is correct, that is acceptable. And a lot of ancient mythologies tend to be somewhat in conflict with that. And yet, I think part of growing spiritually is taking a step away from the mainstream modern thought and kind of learning to look at the world in that, you know, open-minded way where things are possible that perhaps modern psychology and, you know, the modern geist say aren't.
Yeah, well, anytime you start studying a religion, it helps to, you know, approach it with an open mind. And I always found, one of my teachers told me that it's always best to go into it with a mind that's willing to accept what they say. I mean, that's one of the things that has really personally offended me about a lot of Christians that I interact with, is that they come at you with, well, okay, you worship this God, but he's not as powerful as my God, so what's the point? Well, to my perspective, my God is as powerful, if not more, than the Christian God, okay? Yes, from the perspective of Christianity, his God has to be the most powerful thing out there, and I understand that. If you can't wrap your mind around how another person sees their own spirituality, you're never going to understand it well enough to be able to interact with them.
It's very true. And, I mean, it seems to me that the reason that there are, you know, even pagan fundamentalists is that somehow the idea of having the most powerful god or pantheon means that you have the truest spiritual path. And I mean, I don't know. That seems to be a bit juvenile.
It's
as far
counterproductive.
As I'm
concerned. Yeah. My God's bigger than your God. My God can beat up your God.
So, I mean, from that perspective, I kind of like the, you know, the sort of Hindu version of seeing every god as the related face that you most connect with, that is part of the big, you know, spiritual source that exists. But at the same time, I mean, each pantheon in itself has to stand alone, because otherwise the cultures that, you know, lived their lives relating to them wouldn't have. I mean, but at the time I also don't see that, you know, there was that big fixation on having the truest spiritual path, because I think in the days where people were more polytheistic,
mm-hmm.
were more open to other gods existing. I don't think that there was quite the conflict that people perceive as having existed.
Right. Because it was more common that you could understand easier the fact that this other person had deities that were special to them, since you had several deities that were special to you, instead of having one god that's also three gods, that's also one god, that's also three gods, you know. And it's, I don't know, something got twisted around at some point, and I really don't know how to fix it these days, but hopefully, you know, things will get better as time progresses. Okay, we could spend all night on just this topic. Let's move on to something else.
That's so true.
Yeah, bards, ovates, brehons, and druids. We've been throwing these terms around a little bit, and it's probably a good thing to talk about what they actually are. Everybody thinks they know what a bard is. Bard is somebody that stands up on a stage and plays a lute and sings for you, okay? Except that's not all that a bard is. True bards that the druids had were not only the creators of music, but the creators of poetry. They were the people that could write music, write poetry, play instruments. They could talk. They could orate like Abraham Lincoln could. They could expound on many, many topics. And while they were trained for about 12 years to get the title of bard, they were not seen as lesser than anything. It's simply that their title, their talents, pushed them towards performing and being in the public eye. Okay, Brian and I were actually, before this show started, we had a call last week and we talked about some of these topics. One of the things that came up is, who would you call a modern day bard? And I'll tell you truthfully, there's only a few performers that I can think of that I would actually call a bard. And they're people like Bobby McFerrin. Have you ever seen this man perform? He can play his body like an instrument and make it sound while he's standing all alone on stage like there's six other people with him. And he does this all improvisationally, which means he's not going into it with this already scripted out and he already knows what he's doing. He's doing this off the cuff. And doing albums and directing the Boston Pops, which is, you know, this tremendously huge concert group, orchestra.
Nice.
You know, and he's absolutely amazing. Yo-Yo Ma, the cellist, was in awe of his ability. Because they sat down at one point. Yo-Yo Ma is playing a piece on his cello, and Bobby is with him and doing counterpoint while Yo-Yo is doing the main melody. And Yo-Yo, when he says that at one point he, you know, wants to have the performance as much alike as the next one. He doesn't like throwing in improvisation. He doesn't like changing things. He doesn't like getting lost. He wants it, you know, mechanically precise every time. And he puts a lot of feeling into that. I mean, don't get me wrong, he's a brilliant cellist, but he wants it the same. And he sat down with Yo-Yo, or with Bobby, who's doing nothing by any script, by any sheet music. He's just doing it all off the cuff, and Yo-Yo is on the record saying he was in awe of Bobby McFerrin's ability in this, and said something along the lines of, he taught me how to improvise while I'm playing on the cello, which for a concert cellist of Yo-Yo Ma's level is jaw-dropping, in my opinion. You know, but it's
for
not.
Sure.
It's also not just musicians. George Clooney, I would call a bard. His performances are just immense. Now, granted, they edit him together, but he's also done a lot of improv. Kevin Spacey is another person that I would call a modern bard.
Mm-hmm.
He does Broadway. He does movies. He does writing. He does directing. He is currently the head of the London Theater in London, you know, that the Queen goes to. The man's accomplishments just run off of the page. And there's more. You know? So this is the kind of level that these guys would have to train to in that first 12 years just to get the title Bard. And everybody else had to have the title Bard before they could move on to Ovate or to Druid or to Brihan. Okay? So, you know, this is not a small accomplishment.
Well, I think, too, that there's an element in Bardic, in the Bardic arts that, you know, where they're historians as well, and they're the they're kind of the guys who are in charge of memorizing a particular king's family tree and history and all the accomplishments mm-hmm. of his family members leading to his reign, etc.
Mm-hmm.
There's also an element where the bard is expected to flatter. You know, he writes songs to praise his particular king or, you know, whoever, the guy sponsoring him, basically. because, you know, this, the fact that you can bolster someone's ego, or, you know, alternatively use satire and insults to, like, undermine someone's confidence, there are elements of what bards do, you know, and you see that kind of touched on in role-playing games where you have the bards that have songs that boost, you know, your party's ability or, like, turn, you know, the enemy's abilities into crap. But this is actually based on what bards did. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that you had to learn. I'm not familiar with slam poetry in any major way, but I think there are probably slam poets that are probably very bardic in what they do. Because I think
I do know that.
Go ahead.
I do know that a guy that back in Ireland, the bards, when they camped over at a Grian or something, were expected to, you know, come up with a thanks song based on the hospitality they got. And a king's reign could be absolutely destroyed if a bard gave a bad review and publicized it by singing about so-and-so the ungenerous. And the king would literally lose his position. And that's exactly what it was. It was a review of the king.
Well, and I
so,
that...
you know,
Go ahead. Well, I
no,
think
the reason
kind...
we keep talking the reason we keep winding up talking over each other, everybody, is because we're on Skype and there's a slight delay from when he says something and when I say something, where we've got this empty space and I don't think he's going to say anything, and then he starts to say something and we're talking on each other. So go ahead, Brian.
I lost my train of thought.
Okay. Well, that happens. It derails. So, okay, and that's what a bard was. And the Ovates were diviners. They were the people that read the omens in the skies. They told the people what the gods desired, what was coming up based on what they were seeing. And this was, everybody would think that, okay, this is just, you know, reading runes or doing tarot card spreads, except it wasn't. Remember the time period that we're talking about. They didn't have Channel 5 Weather Center. What they had was they had the flights of the birds. And so you could tell by observing the insects and the birds and stuff what the weather was going to be like for the next couple days. You could also tell what the winter was going to be like coming up. They could do prophecies through visions. They were expected that when somebody finished building a house and put the door up, that they walked over the threshold first so that they could prophesy based on what jumped into their mind as to what was going to happen with the family. and their fortune and things like that. Okay, they were the people that would that could read the entrails of animals that were sacrificed. They were expected to be in a cave with a 200-pound rock on top of them, sealed in for 5 days under a white ox hide, and then the rock would be removed, the ox hide would be pulled off, lights would be shown in their face, and they were expected to come up with, you know, a prophecy of what was coming up. Okay. This group kind of grew off, at least in the Nordic tradition, into the Spey, to the Spey Wives and the Diviners. Okay, this was what the Ovates did. Okay, and this was an additional couple, 3 years training after they got to Bard level. Okay, the Brehons were kind of specialized. What they wound up doing was they were the lawyers, not the judges, because the judges were the kings. They were the people that kept mental encyclopedias of the laws, of the precedents in the laws, of what happened during this lawsuit. They were pretty much living copies of LexisNexis, which, if you know anything about the internet and legal things, that's the big database that lawyers use to find all the case law. Okay. But that's what a Brehon was. And they would, you know, advise the king as to what they could do with somebody that was being judged. Cattle thief comes before the king. It was expected that the Brehons would consult their brain and come up with a reasonable punishment based on what their king did before, what had happened in the past to this gentleman, and could come up with something reasonable. They would tell the king, and then the king would actually pronounce it. Now, the king could make it more harsh or less harsh, depending upon what he wanted to do. But the Brehons were living encyclopedias of legal things, okay? And then finally, the Druids are the actual people that do the rituals. The priest class is what I believe Caesar wound up calling them, except they're not just priests. You couldn't be called a druid unless you did know the mythology, the rituals, the magic, the divination, some of the legal stuff, and some of the ways of talking to other tribes during war. A druid was expected to be all of that, okay? But they were somewhat specialized in that once you got out of the legal things and out of educating the next lord's son, that you could, you know, go and commune with the trees and come back with a prediction for what was going to happen next year, okay? And so that's what we're talking about when we throw out Bard, Ovate, Brehon, and Druid, okay? That's where the terms come from. That's as close a definition as I've ever been able to come to with it. Okay, so we're talking about a lot of information, a lot of knowledge, a lot of study in the various groups. And yes, some druids were specialized in certain things. There were people that, you know, specialized in a specific type of magic. There were some that were specialized in killing things very efficiently. There were, you know, people that took care of magic for old people, and others that took care of the rites and rituals for the children, and so forth and so on.
Well, and I think, too, that it's important to realize that the idea of the druids is that that's just kind of an overall header for specialized, you know, departments, I guess, because each path may have been kind of a level of training, but it may also, for the particular individual, it would have been a specialized lifelong branch of discipline. Much like, you know, your lawyers, your tarot card readers, your
doctors,
whatever other kind of professional or, you know, laborer that might have been. I've always used to talk about there being five subsections for each kind of level class of society, I guess. So you have, like, kind of the druids, the warriors, etc., but you also have sub-branches of that with special different things. So you didn't have, like, the druids, the priest class guys, or women, as the case may have been.
You kind of did, and this is something that I did want to talk about. This is what I'm going to talk about here is complete UPG, and we touched on this on another episode of something, and that's unverified personal gnosis, okay, which is an idea came to somebody at some time that connected a lot of scattered pieces of information, but there's no written information or direct information that verifies it. Okay, this is to explain the UPG. I was meditating on the differences between Wicca and Druidism for a long time. I wrote an article about it. So that Wiccans can understand Druids and Druids can understand Wiccans. Apparently, a lot of people liked it. It's a very good article, if I do say so myself. one of the piece of UPG that came during this time was that there was a separation of the sexes. Okay, there are written accounts of female druids running around doing spells, wild hair, getting the courage of the fighters up before Anglesey was overrun by the Romans in one of the last fights together, which pretty much spelled the end for the druids. What occurred to me is that if you look at Wiccan practices, it's concerned with fertility. It's concerned with the health of the people, with the health of the land, with the health of the animals, with rituals on the cycles of the seasons and the agrarian everything, and the life cycles of a girl's first menses or a boy's, you know, wet dream when they're actually considered to be grown-ups. With their marriage, with getting together, with communing with nature, okay? Whereas the druids, as a group, tend to be more focused on the overall picture of everything, not necessarily the crops, but also the health of the entire land, so that these crops in this field, yes, are doing poorly, but they're not as important as the crops that are over here, which are more important to everybody, and understanding that balance between the two of them, okay? And Wicca seemed to be, you know, very insular and isolated to a small group of people, where Druidism seemed to be more all-encompassing, okay? And the UPG that came was that the Celts had sexual division. It wasn't egalitarian as everybody tends to think it was, where women were equal to men, okay? There was an understanding that women were suited to certain jobs more than men, and men were more suited to other jobs more than women. Now, if there was crossover where a female, you know, wanted to be a warrior and run out and scream and chop people into little bits, she was welcomed with open arms, just as if there was a man who felt like he wanted to stay home and take care of the children, he was allowed to do that, and there was no social stigma there, okay? But for the most part, women did stay at home, and the men went out and waged war. And that was the way it was supposed to be. So isn't it possible that all of these traditions that we have in Wicca developed with the females in the Celts and stayed active because it was hidden and isolated, whereas the Druids, who were mostly men and were out front and were visible by the Romans, were wiped out because they were a threat, and they were seen as a threat, and they were seen as an opposition, whereas all of the granny tales and all of the herb lore and all of the rituals for the fields went into hiding mostly, where it was less obvious that it was still there, but it was still in the background. So we have this wealth of information that is focused on the female, which was incorporated into Wicca, and all of the stuff that was focused on the male and the overall everything died out when the Romans came running in and saw them as a threat and wiped them out. That was my UPG, okay? I have no way of verifying
that's entirely possible.
It reasonable, makes actually. Reasonable sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, it definitely does. Because, I mean, as much as I think modern people try to create an egalitarian, you know, gender-neutral kind of idyllic paradise pre-patriarchy, let's say, I think ultimately that the truth of the matter is that there was always this expectation of, you know, each gender fulfilling particular roles within, you know, society. I don't, however, think that it's kind of a bad thing. I think that ultimately you're looking at something very similar to any of the native cultures that exist around the world, you know, you've got like the men who, because they can't give birth, you know, what else do they do but go out hunting while the women look after the kids and so on. It's not like there's a stigma or a negative idea behind that. I mean, ultimately, this is just nature running its course. And I think when you look at something along the line of, you know, the tomboy phenomenon that exists nowadays, you know, why wouldn't it exist, you know, in the Iron Age or whatever? I mean, a girl that predominantly likes what are classed as boyish things would obviously want to do them. And in most cultures outside of the ones that define each gender as having to fit a particular checklist, a definition, there would be no real problem with that. I mean, you've got like the Berdash culture in Native American spiritual and cultural, you know, expression, where you've got these men who are, I don't know exactly how they're defined, but they're men who want
two-spirit.
To, yeah, yeah, the two-spirit phenomenon, where they're kind of born in a way that doesn't sort of fit the stereotypical male behavior pattern, but at the same time, that's not looked down upon. It's actually seen as being spiritually significant, and therefore they're allowed to live as women, basically.
Or
you know,
however they define themselves.
Well, exactly. And, I mean, the whole idea seems to me that it wouldn't be isolated to, North America. It wouldn't be a new world thing. It would be like all over, you know, the world. I mean, throughout human history.
It would make reasonable sense. I mean, just looking at a man and a woman standing next to each other, natural selection has made men stronger, more powerful, broader shoulders, deeper chest, more suited to things requiring power and strength, okay? Whereas women have been developed wider hips, breasts, thinner, more lithe, more flexible, designed for things where they're getting into small spaces, like you do when you're hunting herbs, maybe, and quickness as opposed to power. Okay, and I mean that's natural selection, and so you have a genetic predisposition to that, and it's going to come to the fore. You know, you're naturally going to wind up having jobs that fall to people where sitting there scraping a hide requires controlled power, but not a lot of strength. It requires being able to be flexible so that you can do it for hours. I don't know how many guys out there have actually sat down and tried to scrape out the hair off a deer skin. It takes hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of sitting in the same position, making the same repetitive motions, and that gets wearing. I can't see Arnold Schwarzenegger doing that. He'd be complaining 10 minutes into it that it hurts. But I can see Maria Shriver doing it because that's how, you know, the genetics have selected us to do. Okay, and I'm probably going to be thrown out of the girl club now. But that's an entirely different show, okay? This is something we've talked about, we're going to do.
Anyway. Yeah, it's what Joy and I do. I mean, we'll go off on tangents that kind of touch on something that we're talking about, but, you know, they stand alone on their own as well. You're welcome to call in and refute us, bitch us out, whatever you want. Ultimately, we're not going to stop you from doing that because if you disagree...
Hey, it's all opinion.
Exactly. I mean, this, I think, is an issue that it's part of your life. And, I mean, it's part of spiritual paths as well. And I do actually think that, like, the... what became kind of called witchcraft, you know, the herbal healing and, you know, the midwifery and all this kind of stuff, all the I guess you would call them women's arts, managed to survive because they were part of daily life. You know, you didn't have doctors. You went out and hunted herbs and you can consult faith healers and what have you. So the fact that those roles managed to survive to become what modern day pagans call witchcraft is perfectly reasonable. Whereas you've got things like all the Brehean laws and all this kind of stuff that are very intellectual that probably over time would have given way to new ways of thinking, new understandings of the world. So they didn't have the sustainability that I think, you know, daily life arts would have had.
Right. Not unless you're actually working at it. And that we're going to bring it back into Druidism and Druidry now, simply to the fact that the divisions between male and female, Wicca and the sexual everything is an entirely different show, and we have one plan for this, okay? So we're going to be talking about this in the future, but we're going to touch on it now, and we're going to move on now because this can get really complex really quick.
Folks, you do have to realize, especially if you haven't heard our previous show, Tarot Talk and Magic Mondays, Joy and I will do this kind of thing. We put a theme on the show, but we will talk about things that are wild and totally off topic. It's partly because our minds just work that way. We want to incorporate so much into our you know, each show that we just end up doing that.
There's so much to say also.
Bad thing.
No, it's usually not, but and that's why we're going to do it every week, because there is so much to say. Let's see, we talked about the Bardic Info, the Magic and Divination. What we got to touch on now is the different groups that are out there. And you got to understand there are so many different groups that we can't tell you everything about all of them. What we can do is give you classifications of the groups, okay? There are four main branches of Druidism and Druidry right now. There's the Reformed Druids of North America. There's the OBAD, which is the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids. There's the ADF, which is the Ard Drakhod Nafen, which is a Druid friendship. When it's translated, and then there's the Henge of Keltria, okay? Each one of these is very distinct from the other, but they all have roots in the same thing, all right? So let me give you a quick rundown on the development of these. As we said, the John Tolan's Fraternal Orders, the Druid Bond, stuck around through a couple world wars, and wound up somewhere in the 1800s turning into the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids. The focus changed from being a fraternal order back into being a religious order, kind of like the Freemasons. But with the discovery of a whole bunch of books by Ilio Mornwig, and I'm probably mangling that name, the focus turned back into Celtic spirituality, and thus the OBOD was born. The tomes are supposedly lost writings from the actual Welsh Druids, and it lays out a divinity and a faith path that is very close to what you would find explained in the Mabinogion. Which is there are levels of the world. We have a level that is below our universe, where everybody starts from, all the souls come from. You're born into that, you live a life there, you die, you are promoted up through the ranks until you get here, to this world, to this plane, the physical. You live your life here, you do what you're supposed to do, you die, and if you've been good enough, if you've worked hard enough, you are promoted again to a higher level. And this process continues on and on and on ad nauseum. As far as I know, there's only the three levels that are talked about, but I believe it's infinite progression. You keep going up and keep going deeper and deeper and deeper and getting more and more purified as you go along, okay? It talks very much about the gods and goddesses of the Bright World, Arduin and Anuvin and Pwyll and Pryderi and Rhiannon of the Birds and Gilvathwe and Math and on and on and on, okay? And these are the deities of the Welsh Mabinogion. If you can't tell, I've studied them extensively because I worship them myself. And this is what the OBOD is currently, and it's wonderful. The only problem that I personally have with it is that a lot think that the Ilio books are actual from Druids, written down, and that's fine if they want to believe that. It's been proven to my satisfaction, however, that he wrote them himself. Okay, so that's one of the main branches of Druidry now. Then you have the Reformed Druids of North America, the RDNA. The RDNA kind of developed independently of any other Druid order because there was a college that decided that it wanted to have religious religious rituals in all college events, and that it was mandatory for everyone that attended college. A group of students got together and went to hell with that and decided that they were going to come up with a whole new religion, call it Druidry, and that they were going to have it recognized. And the college went, okay, you're right, that's a religion, go for it. What are your beliefs? And all of the students were kind of like, what? So they actually had to research at this point and figure out what they wanted to believe. They started out with a lot of the information from the OBOD and changed it. Now, this is in probably the 60s. So you also have somewhere right in there, yeah. So you have the influence of Wicca starting to come in with Gardner and him sending around his rituals. You've got the Freemasons. You've got the Obad stuff. You've got, you know, a whole bunch of information out there. And they came up with an entire system that was completely independent of all of this. And it's based on, to be honest, I don't know, because I haven't studied the RDNA in depth, okay? I do know that it's one of the valid Druid paths out there. It's really good to my understanding. Go ahead, Brian. You probably know more.
I mean, I didn't really go deep into RDN because it was kind of my, early wanderings into the Druid path, I guess. RDNA started as kind of a joke, actually, because Carleton College had a religious requirement for its student. You had to be part of a particular, or like any particular religion, in order to be a student there. And a bunch of folks got together who just kind of were like, what? Screw this. We don't want to be Christians. We don't want to be Jewish or this or, you know, whatever, because those are very dogmatic religions. And what ended up happening is that RDNA was formed. It sort of lighthearted, humorous way, because they wanted something that they personalized that still classed as a religion or that met their requirements, but allowed them to express their, you know, their own interest in poetry and spirituality, etc. So a lot of the material you'll find, if you go to the RDNA website, I can't remember what they add, it's actually not RDNA, anything like that. It's subpage on someone's thing. So you can look up Reformed Druids of North America on Google, you'll find it. They have hundreds of pages of information on sort of their formation and tradition over the years. You find Druidry, Sufism, etc. Tons of influence, really fascinating stuff. And it actually was kind of the order that Isaac Bowen came out of when he started the ADF.
Right. And that's the segue into the next part. Because I've talked to Isaac before he died. Understand also that, yes, he had all the information from the RDNA when they started out, but he also had his own studies from Berkeley. Now, I don't know how many of you know who Isaac Bonowitz is or was, but he is the only person ever in the history of colleges to have a degree in magic and thaumaturgy, literally. At the time when he was studying in Berkeley, they had a choose-your-own degree type thing. You could take whatever courses you want and earn a degree in it. Well, he took such courses as comparative religions, spiritualism, metaphysics. They had classes in meditation and spiritualism, comparative religions. And he wound up doing his master's dissertation on religion in general. Now, he wasn't trying to get a divinity degree. What he wound up being awarded was a master's in magic and thaumaturgy. And then Berkeley immediately turned around and closed that loophole so that they couldn't, so that nobody else could earn it. While he was there, he was also part of the Church of Satan with Anton LaVey. He is in the video, in fact, The Occult Exposed, or The Occult Experience, at Anton LaVey's church in one of their rituals.
That's hilarious. I didn't know that.
Yes, he is in there.
Same ritual that they used in that documentary that was about the Church of Satan. Satanus, the Devil's Nest.
Yeah,
because there was one video.
According to what he said, during the ritual that they were filming, Anton is there, and Isaac is presenting the chalice to him on his knees at one point. And it's great. But he was, so he was pulling from that background as well. And he got really disaffected with the Church of Satan and didn't know really what to do. And so he started the ADF. He stated that his goal is to have made, he wants a pan-pagan church comparable to the Catholic Church, where you have ministers, where you have worldwide influence, where you have a paid clergy, where you have people that are in Canada who are doing the liturgy and the ritual this way and can go to Paraguay and find an ADF grove there. And it's exactly the same liturgy and the same ritual. And then they both can go over to Japan and find an ADF grove there that's worshiping exactly the same way, even if the gods have changed. And that's pretty much what the ADF has turned into. It started off as Druid. It started off as pagan. And it's turned into this monstrosity, in my opinion, of worldwide proportions, where you have groves everywhere. They're all members of the ADF. They all look to the central archdruid, but each one of them have different deities that they worship in their grove in the same structure of the ADF. Okay. Personally, when I was looking into druidism as an alternative, I saw that and I kind of got turned off of it because somehow, because when I came across the Shinto grove in Japan who had the deities of Amaterasu, I don't even remember her first name, the goddess of the sun, the Shinto goddess of the sun.
Amaterasu, or she's known as, Okami. It literally means great spirit.
They have her as their main deity, but they're still worshiping in a Celtic, pagan, druidic mindset. And my brain broke at that point. And I went, what? And so that kind of turned me off of that. The last major branch that we have is the Henge of Keltria. And the Henge of Keltria seems to be kind of the compromise between everything, okay? Some people that were in the ADF got upset with the pan-worldwide nature of the ADF and decided to start their own druid order that was focused on the deities and the mindset of Ireland. And in my opinion, they nailed it, okay? My own order is a branch off of the Henge of Keltria, and it is very Irish-centric. The Morrigan, the Doida, the Battle of Moytura, the mythology of Ireland, the triads of Ireland, all of that is wrapped into it. Even the magical structure calls upon the four provinces of Ireland as part of the liturgy. So you're dealing with, you know, a very one little area of the world that is shifted to various other areas where you happen to be worshiping at. But you're still evoking and invocating Ireland when you're doing the rituals. So that's what Celtria wound up being. And every single one of these is, you know, a true Druid order. And just about every order that is out there, no matter how small, can trace their roots back to one of these four groups. The Reformed Druids of North America, I think that they wound up being the progenitor of the American Druid group earlier tonight. Yeah. Not the ADF. I don't know. There was a lady in the chat a little earlier.
Oh, AODA, the Ancient Orders of Druids, yeah. Ancient Orders of Druids in America. Those guys actually lived off of that same kind of fraternal Masonic kind of bunch that existed back in 1700s.
Back to the OBOD.
Yeah, their roots are, their roots are like the same as OBOD and AODA.
And then there's the Newgrange Druids, the Loyal Arthurian Warband.
those guys are fun. The Loyal Arthurian Warband is actually a very proactive Druid group based out of England. The leader is actually well known in the British media. His name is Arthur King, but he goes by King Arthur, I believe.
Arthur Pendragon.
So he actually, he goes by that name. They actually made headlines because of the work they did in... I think they helped dispel some British law.
Stonehenge had been closed to the public because it was starting to fall apart. So many people had come through there been trying to do things to the monuments and stuff that they wound up closing the site. You could see it from like a half a mile away, but you couldn't cross this fence. The Loyal Arthurian Warband was really instrumental in getting in there and getting the British Parliament to repeal that law so that people could use it again for what it was intended for, as a worship site. And you've probably seen the solstice pictures, because every winter solstice they go out there and they have a huge ritual. It's attended by something like, I think it was 100,000 people last time. And it's just this major event. But they were big on trying to get that taken care of.
The solstices at Stonehenge have become kind of a pan-pagan pilgrimage destination. And I know that I wouldn't mind being at one of those before I die.
Yeah, neither would I. It's got to be very something.
Oh, I'm sure it's powerful and moving and interesting as hell.
Okay, moving on, because we have less than a half an hour here. Magic and divination. Let's talk about several things together here. Magic, divination, sacrifices, triune thought, and rituals. Understand that Druidism in general is about connecting to the land, okay, and connecting to the areas around you. It's also about connecting to the other worlds, all right? So when you're doing a ritual in Druidry, in general, what you're trying to do is you're trying to connect yourself to what is referred to as the sea, the land, which is all that's physical around us, and the sky, which is where heaven would be in a lot of other mindsets, okay? The sea is where all the magic comes from, where we come from as souls and spirits, where life began. It's the beginning place that we all start out at. The land is obviously the physical world. It is everything that you can see, touch, smell, taste, and hear, okay? It's everything around you. It's the entire observable universe. All of this is part of the land. The sky is the higher realms where the gods dwell at. And this is the point of druidic magic and druidic ritual is to make a connection between yourself and all three of these areas simultaneously, okay? Druidic magic is votive in nature, which means that instead of going, okay, I'm casting the spell and I'm pushing my will out and I'm putting all this energy along with this will and I'm going to make this happen because I want this to happen. You instead go to the gods and say, look, Lady Rhiannon, I love you. I appreciate you. You've done so much for me. I need some help right now, though. I am in a position where I can't take care of my family. I will do things for you. I will write an article about you and tell others about how wonderful you are. Would you please push your energy out into the universe and make this happen for me? Okay, it's a petitioning, it's a quid pro quo. It's what, I can't believe I'm going to say this, what Christian prayer is supposed to be, okay, and very rarely is, because mostly it's, God, do this for me, and it's not a giving back, okay. In votive magic, it is, you have something you want, you're living in the physical world where the gods are not. The gods have things they want from the physical world, like food, like jewelry, like recognition from people. So they expect you to do this favor for them, and in return, they will do this favor for you. It's as simple as that. Now, as part of this, you are expected to actually do what you say you're doing, which is a sacrifice. And this is where a lot of people get really squicked out, because druidic sacrifice is not just take a baby, cut it open, throw its bloody heart on the ground, and chant over it, okay? Sacrifice is anything. Any type of action that you are doing that is your energy going out into the universe, causing something to happen, is a sacrifice by definition. In fact, literally, a sacrifice is to make sacred. If you are making something sacred, then you are committing a sacrifice. Okay? Now, in this case, it's you are taking an action that is causing a sacred energy to be released. Okay? Be that meditation, be that a service, be that an object, or anything like that. You are offering it to the gods as something that is sacred for them. Okay? It's not payment. It's not a bribe. It is simply you realize that anything requires a price. And so you are offering that price to the gods to ask them to do something for you. Now, yes, human sacrifice did occur in ancient times, back before the Romans came around, and I'm sure while the Romans were there, because they have written accounts of it. But it was not the bloody torture that Caesar and Pliny wrote about, okay? Because the reasoning there is, how can you have a soul of a sacrifice petition the gods directly if that soul is tortured just before they leave their body? Okay? And that's the crux of the whole thing. The sacrifice, the human sacrifices of the time typically were slaves, were prisoners of war, taken in battle, okay? But these people were going to be they were lost to their tribe anyway. When they were defeated in battle, their tribe went, okay, fuck them. They're dead to us because they lost, okay? But they're still alive in a physical body in the tribe that they that captured them, okay? But they're going to always be an outcast. They're never going to be truly welcomed into the tribe. They're going to be slaves, okay? So an opportunity comes up where there's a desperate need for this magic to work for the good of this tribe. The druids come to the prisoner and say, okay, we need a sacrifice. We need somebody to take our plea directly from us to the gods in person and plead our case, because this is a really dire type of thing. You're going to die.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We're going to make sure that you die. Okay? In my opinion,
go ahead.
You know, that would be a more honorable death than slowly dying in shame in slavery and servitude.
Yeah, it'd be like the scapegoat kind of tradition in like the Middle East. And the thing too with practice of sacrifice, based on the evidence that we have from like scientific examination of bog bodies, of, you know, various, I mean, it's mostly from the bog bodies, and it probably is from historical accounts as well, but it's not like you went in fully alive type. You would have been given like a drug cocktail, basically. So you would have been bothering, crazy talk, but that in itself was regarded as words from the gods that people just didn't understand because they weren't, you know, translated. They were just, you know, the gods speaking through this person. So you were completely out of your mind, hopped up on, I don't know, earth or mushrooms or whatever. You would have been out of it before you went into die. You know, and it wasn't like we're being tossed whole hog onto a fire. There were other ways that you would have been sacrificed.
The deaths were really quick. I mean, looking at the bog bodies, yes, they're restrained. Yes, their throat is slit. Yes, their head is caved in. But these are absolutely sure deaths. The slitting of the throat will kill the person. If that does not kill the person, the crushing the head definitely will. And if they're still alive after those two, like Rasputin somehow, they're thrown into the bog while restrained. They're definitely dead. These were merciful killings. These were quick killings. Because if you have a disoriented, drug-induced, pained soul who's leaving their body, they really can't plead your case very well to the gods. Because they're going, oh,
it's very true.
So you wanted this to be quick. And yes, the wicker men probably did happen, but it wasn't, they're restrained in the wicker man, and then it's set afire, and they're screaming in pain because they're burning alive. They were dead from smoke inhalation before the flames ever got to their body. The flames were simply the mechanism to send their physical body to the gods as well. Okay, and
you'll
that's all that it was.
Kind of, you'll see burnt offerings in cultures all over the world as well. I mean, it's not an uncommon thing. Fire is considered a very powerful tool in connecting with the gods. Modern druid orders like ADF, for instance, use fire as one of their three hallows in ritual, because throughout ancient cultures. I mean, you'll see it in the Vedic cultures, Hindu worship ceremonies. Fire is a very powerful kicking tool for the gods. So,
and if you look at one of the
fire.
Okay, if you look at one of the pieces of magic that we have left over, the dooley from the Celts, there's this whole list of associations of elements and body parts and things in the land. Okay, if you look through this list, you'll see elements for the spirit, you'll see elements for the physical, and you'll see elements for the emotional, okay, which can directly relate to the land, the sea, and the sky again, okay? What you will not see in any of them is fire. There is no fire in the dooley anywhere. There is no mention of fire in the cauldrons, in any of the druidic magic, because fire was sacred. It was sacred. It was part of the gods. It was the eraser of the gods. If you have a forest and the lightning strikes it and the fire starts and wipe out the forest, that's the gods starting over there. That was sacred. That was part of the natural order. You didn't try to stop it. You got the hell out of its way. But you didn't, you know, try to keep it from happening. You encouraged it. Now, you didn't go out and burn down the entire forest yourself. If the gods decided that they were going to cause a lightning strike and start a forest fire, that was their prerogative. You know, you husbanded the resources correctly, but, you know, you didn't interfere with it either because it was part of what was going on. And you had to have that destruction before you could have the creation to come after it. Okay, which brings us to the next thing, triune thought and the fact that it permeates everything about druidic practice and thought. Triune thought is not binary thought. Binary thought is good and evil. You have man and woman. You have black and white. You have off and on. Okay, you have two states for everything. All right. This is what a lot of the religions of the books, what a lot of the Western religions have, notably Christianity, Hinduism, Judaism, the Big Five. There's a lot of binary thought wrapped into it, except for Buddhism. In Buddhism and in Druidism, you have a range of possibilities. You not only have good and bad, you have kind of gray, okay? Because what's good for you may be bad for somebody else, but from your perspective, you're doing good, and somebody else's perspective, you're doing bad. How can you fit that into good and evil? You can't. So it's a shade in there, okay? You don't have just on or off. You have that state just in between when it's getting dim. You don't have day and night. You have twilight as well. There's a whole time period in there where the light is going away, and it's a changeover from one state to another. You don't have the caterpillar and the butterfly. You have the chrysalis as well, where it's growing and changing. And this philosophy is part of everything in Druidism. If there's no other concept that is vital, this is it, okay? You have male, you have female, but you also have those poor souls that are right in the middle, okay, of being both, the two-spirit people, the people like me who are transgender, the gays and lesbians, the everybody else is also part of it, okay? They're in there, and they're part of the natural order of things, and you can't get rid of them and say, no, there's only male and female. There's nothing else. So this is, you know, critical to understanding Druidism, that there's not only one thing, there's other things. There's mind, body, and spirit. There is soul. good, evil, and gray. There are a range of colors between red and purple. Okay, and without all of those, you got nothing. You lose 98% of the wonder of the universe without understanding that. And that's why trees are sacred to the druid. It's not that we're standing there worshiping the tree. It's that the tree connects all of them. The tree connects the water table through the roots to the land, which you can see and touch, and into the sky where the leaves are at. I mean, let's face it. This is a creature that lives off of light and air.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's incredibly complex. But to the old druids, they would have seen that and they would have gone, okay, it's getting energy from the sky, from the gods. It's getting water from under the land, and it's physical, and it gives us so much. And this is why they honored the trees, because it connected all three of them, and it encompassed the entire mindset of triune thought in one thing.
Well, exactly.
Which, you know, Go ahead.
The idea
still with me?
Tree. Yeah. Am I not?
Okay. Now, on my end, you're breaking up a lot. That might be just my computer.
Okay.
I'm only getting maybe about half the words. So go ahead. World tree.
But when you look into the European shamanic traditions, you're dealing with a world tree kind of theme. That links land, sea, and sky, underworld, middle world, and upper world. You've got that represented, you know, in various mythologies, depending on where in Europe you're talking about. I mean, certain places had a world mountain instead because mountains were more prevalent and bigger and more obvious. Well, exactly. I mean, the whole idea was that this particular pillar or tree or mountain or what have you was the link between every level of existence so that you could travel as a priest or a shaman into the underworld where you could relate to spirits, to feel, or to, you know, bring good crops or whatever, or you could, you know, appeal to the beings in the upper world to, I don't know, bring your child into the world or help you advance spiritually or what have you. I mean, each world had its particular use, and as a trained shaman or priest, you could access those worlds through a world tree or a ritual pillar or what have you.
So,
hello? Oh.
Okay. No, I'm here. Well, okay. We've been on this call for about 52 minutes or an hour and 52 minutes now. We're getting close to the end and it sounds like things are starting to break up. Real quick, there are a few other things. One of them is Wicca may be based on a lot of Celtic knowledge, but it's not Celtic in and of itself. There is a lot of stuff that was left out. So it may have its roots there, but it's not how the Druids and the Celts of the olden days worshipped, no matter what anybody tries to tell you. Druidism is one of those religions where it's not fed to you with a spoon. You're expected to do work. Most notably, you're expected to study the mythology, to study what came before, and to work at integrating the knowledge that you get from those books into your own mind, and you're expected to come up with your own stuff, your own mental associations. So I had one student tell me that Druidism was the only religion with homework, which actually was pretty accurate at the time. All right, so let me really quickly talk to you about what it takes to bring magical musings to you. We have to pay for space on the internet for our website. We have to pay for Woodwoes Radio to have an account to allow you to have to hear 2 hours of our podcast instead of a half hour with branding all over it. We have, you know, the expenses for the domain name. Now, while we would love for you to just be able to throw money at us because we're such great people, we realize that that's not probably going to happen. There is a donate button on the website at magicalmusings.net. If you feel inclined, if you've got some extra cash, please, we'd love for you to throw it at us. If you would like to buy advertising space with us, we have that too. Just contact us through the website. We'll be glad to talk to you about it and figure out what's good for you and what's good for your budget. And it'll probably get us all taken care of. But for now, I'm Joy. I have a website at aaronsjournal.com. Brian is on the other end. He's been pretty silent for most of this. I think I've been talking over him a lot. He's got his own blogs. And
websites. Y'all are familiar with that.
Oh, yeah. We are going to be doing this. Go ahead.
Well, I was just mentioning my blog. If anyone wants to hit me up on Tumblr, it's cosmic-rebirth.tumblr.com. You can send emails to us at either Brian or Joy at magicalmusings.net.
Mm-hmm.
And check out our website, you know.
Please do.
Take a
and
look
tell-
at the... Oh, yeah. Definitely. Tell
more
people.
More than anything else. Yeah, more than anything else. We're only connected to a very extremely small percentage of the pagan community worldwide. The best way, if you don't have money, if you can't buy advertising space, if you can't do anything else, if you like the show, tell somebody about it. Okay? We are here to help you guys understand all of the cryptic clues that are in the books that aren't out there and explained anywhere. We've got 500,000 books out there talking about Paganism 101 and giving you the basics and what this tool means and what that ritual is about and this holiday and where you go here and these deities, but hardly any of them ever talk about your personal connection with a deity and how to get it and what you do once you have it. I mean, one of the shows that we've got coming up is dealing with your own gods. You know, nobody, I've seen no books that talk about what to do when your deity comes to you, kicks you in the head in the middle of the night at 3 a.m. and says, get into full ritual garb and go out to this park and stand there. But it happens. It happens every week. For a while there, I was pretty much living in my ritual garb, and just about anybody that has a really close relationship with their deity is nodding their head, almost breaking their neck, because it happens all the time. And you know what? You're allowed to say no. So, you know, the books don't talk about this stuff, but we will. So if you like it, tell them. Tell others. Get them involved. Get them downloading the podcast. Get them to the website. Maybe they have a couple of dollars, and if they don't, they can tell two friends, and they'll tell two friends, and they'll tell two friends, and now it sounds like a shampoo commercial.
Exactly. But, yeah, seriously, folks, help us out. If you like the show, pass the word around. Let people know about us. Tonight was our first episode, so, you know, hopefully you'll get a feel for what the show's going to be. But... you know, I assure you it will get better as time goes on. It always does.
Oh, yeah.
Because it takes a little while to adjust to the whole weekly show thing and, you know, that sort of deal, because this is just real life. You know, we're doing the show in the midst of a real life outside of the show. So, you know, we've got things
trying
to prepare
find a job,
each week,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Among other things. Exactly.
Speaking of next week is going to be rituals and their structure. We're going to be talking about not only rituals, but how to create them, coming up with off-the-cuff rituals, what you really need for a ritual, things like that, okay, the advanced ritual magic, and actually also the goals of your ritual. If you're not feeling something, you're doing it wrong.
Exactly. So we have like 40 seconds, folks. I do want to thank you for joining us tonight. Join us next week, and don't be afraid to sit in the chat room and interact with us. We don't fight, and we won't swear at you if we don't get that vibe from you. Have a good night, folks.
Take care, everyone.